Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
Well, one thing they did was develop a common vision of an alternative to inspire the sacrifice that was involved in making those changes. Because there was, of course, pushback from the economic elite. Troops were called out, repression, people were put in jail, people were killed while they were engaged nonviolently in campaigns for change. And one of the things that inspired people to keep on struggling was the fact that they had a vision of how different things could be. They had to believe in the possibility that a democracy can create an economy that is democratic. And they believed and pushed the 1%, pushed the economic elite out of power.
That's author and professor George Lakey, setting the stage for us today on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Greetings, I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and chair emeritus of the Public Banking Institute. Professor Lakey, whom we'll hear from a bit later in the program, is describing what it took for the Scandinavian Viking countries of 100 years ago to transform their countries from repressive, squalid economies ruled by financial oligarchs into the world's most vibrant, democratic, and fair economic success on the planet. Of course, it's also intended to provide us with some encouragement as we face off against the growing financial and political control of our own elite here in America, where almost half our population lives on the borderlines of poverty, here in the richest country of the world. Today, we're going to focus on a couple of encouraging developments, a bracing evaluation of the core problems of our financial system, and a review of an earlier discussion we had with George Lakey that illustrates how things can come along in America as we pursue a new age of economic justice and fairness. Let me put some of this in a personal perspective for a moment, if I may. I just had the privilege of spending a few weeks in France, where I took my first in-person look at the remarkable achievements and glories of that country's history and beauty. It was the legacy of the Louis, the King Louis, that is, that provided me with an indulgent dessert of visual spectacle and excess that's a testament to human accomplishment, albeit forced by the hands of repressive financial overlords. The fantastic chateaus, fortresses, and other physical vestiges of the obscene wealth they lived with were stunning. For example, in Paris, I saw a huge domed church once topped in real gold, about the size of a typical U.S. state capitol, that a King Louis built just so that his family could go to church. And then there are the numerous, fabulous, and huge chateaus with hundreds of rooms where the royal set could vacation in the country, some of them used only a handful of times. What I saw was a concentrated visage of the boundless avarice and arrogance to which a privileged financial elite will go when unrestrained by other powers. Now, of course, we know that that particular French dynasty wound up at the guillotine, so that's probably where the similarities end. But while the French Revolution certainly demonstrated the power of citizen action against despotic tyranny, the tranquil passivity of American citizens and their ignorance about being financially abused points us toward different and undoubtedly better solutions. We are indeed in a transformative moment, driven in part by the transformations occurring in technology and connectivity. Our money is part of that, of course. And while we see new tech players and power players on the monetary stage, the same old power centers and systems of dominating private capital remain. Going back to George Lakey's introductory comments, we see that a common vision of a more fair economic system is needed, and the dogged determination of the people is also necessary to realize the economic changes we want, just as they were in France 200 years ago. Well, several encouraging systemic developments have emerged over recent weeks, and we have Ellen Brown here to talk about them.
Well, Ellen, here we are halfway through the new year, and we started in our discussion about money and public banking, which has really represented one of the real breakthrough ideas about how monetary control can be restored for the people. So much has been going on there around the United States. But you and I have both been very fortunate to have recently spent, and just now concluding, a number of weeks in Europe. You in Switzerland, me in France. And we both have observations that we want to share with our listeners. But interestingly, there has been some very significant developments internationally and around the monetary topics. And I'm really looking forward to hearing your take and your input on one of the ones that we'll get to in a moment, which is the idea which you've fostered and done a great deal of work around. And I know it's central to some of the work that you're doing in writing for a new book around having a central bank for all. Let's start that way. You were in Switzerland, so something new has happened there. Let's start there.
Okay, well, there was a Swiss referendum, a sovereign money referendum, which is sort of a takeoff from positive money in the UK, where the goal would have been to have only the central bank issue money, and then private banks would not be allowed to engage in fractional reserve lending. They would basically be loan funds and would have to get the money, real money, from somewhere else and not just be creating it on their books, as we now know that banks do. So it didn't pass, but it did get 25% of the vote, which shows that there's definite interest in monetary reform. And it raised awareness. You know, people are becoming more and more aware of where money comes from. So there are actually what I would call insurmountable issues with this sovereign money approach, one of which is that we actually need bank-created money, I think. I mean, to me, the solution is not to eliminate the ability of banks to create money, but to change the ownership of the banks. In other words, the banks should be public utilities. They should be mandated to serve the public, and they should be nonprofit organizations so that their profit would go back to the government or whoever they're. I mean, you've got the Sparkasm model where they're not actually owned by the government, but they are nonprofits, so their money goes back into their own system and not to shareholders, not to big high-paid CEOs, and they don't have any motivation to gamble because they don't make any extra money for gambling away the bank's money. So that would be my preferred solution, would be public banks. But anyway, it's very interesting that they're raising awareness on these issues. And, well, in Switzerland, what's interesting about it being in Switzerland is that here you have all these cantons that are separated by mountains, and apparently, historically, that's why they have their own little local governments, which are very active. But you can bring a referendum, a national referendum, on anything if you get enough people signing up for it. Whereas in the U.S., we don't have such a thing as a national referendum. We have some states allow referendums by the citizens, so California does, but not even all states. So that's interesting that you have a country here with a central bank that you can actually bring a referendum that could change, if it got voted in, it would actually change the structure of the central bank. I mean, we don't have any form of power to change our own central bank except maybe to write and talk about it and hope to raise awareness and someday have a populist movement that's... We don't even necessarily need a populist movement. That's the thing. There have now been three very interesting studies since February by central bankers themselves. Central bankers, treasury officials or ex-treasury advisors, and law professors. So these are all academics that are coming from the central bank itself, or many of them are, recommending that the central bank should open its deposit window to everyone. Right now, only banks are allowed to deposit with the central bank. I mean, they're called reserve accounts, but basically what it means is the banks get to put their money with the central bank. They get quite high interest. They get right now they're getting the Fed funds rate, which is 1.75%, whereas the average for us lowly depositors is 0.05%, like less than a tenth of a percent is the average interest that we're getting on our deposits. And so the first study was done in February by researchers at the St. Louis Fed, and their study was called The Case for Central Bank Electronic Money and the Non-Case for Central Bank Cryptocurrencies, which is pretty interesting because the cryptocurrency movement is highly suspicious of all this talk of central banks coming out with their own digital currencies like Fed coin or a ruble coin, or a number of countries are looking into their own central bank digital currencies. But the thing is, according to the St. Louis Fed researchers, it would not be a cryptocurrency. In other words, it would not be decentralized. By definition, it would be centralized. So you don't need all the crypto stuff, that, and it wouldn't be secret. You don't want it to be usable by whatever drug dealers, et cetera. You've got to have know your customer and all those things that banks are supposed to be keeping track of. So they're saying they should have their own electronic money, and they should open, the central bank should open its deposit window to individuals, but it wouldn't be a cryptocurrency, and it wouldn't be competing with Bitcoin and the other cryptocurrencies. It would be something else. It would be just a central bank digital currency. And the second study that came out was in May, and that was the Bank of England researchers. Interestingly, Ben Dyson was one of the researchers, and he was formerly the head of Positive Money, which was the inspiration for the sovereign money movement in Switzerland, among other places. So the Bank of England study was recommending that we have a central bank digital currency that would be sort of a parallel thing to the bank reserve currency. So everyone could, in other words, have an account at the central bank, in their case, the Bank of England. And this would allow the Bank of England to do numerous things they can't do now, like quantitative easing for the people. They would have direct access to that. And they could directly control interest rates instead of trying to do the quantitative easing they do now, where they basically give a deal to the bank in the hopes that the banks will pass the deal on to the borrowers, but they haven't done that. Or what the banks have done is open up the real estate market even more, which has caused this housing bubble, et cetera. So that hasn't worked out so well. It would be more direct if the central bank directly controlled quantitative easing, for example, for UBI, universal basic income, that kind of thing. And then the third study, which is by three people, so two of them are former Treasury officials, and two of them are law professors, so one of them is one of each.
I just want to take a breath here for a moment, Ellen, because you've a ton of big stuff that you've talked about here. And before we get into this last study, I just want to kind of recap what the gist of what you're laying out here has happened and why. It's because our listeners probably are, I still want them to glaze over with all of this data. Basically, what is developing globally is a desire and a need on the part of the people to get more direct access to the control of their money and to eliminate, either through technology or through policy, a lot of the middle person management of the money, where the costs and the control is in the hands of the private banking industry. And so that, I think, is the general need and message of some of this work. And now what you're talking about, this latest report that you're setting up, is about a thing called a Fed account, which eliminates the middleman in a major way, but also has huge implications for how our monetary system in the U.S. could work. So with that, let me give it back to you.
Thank you. Yeah. So the third set of researchers are saying you don't even need a central bank digital currency. Just open the Fed's deposit window to everyone. Give everyone an account at the Fed. So we could get 1.75% interest on our deposit accounts, and we could get all the other perks that banks get by having an account at the Fed. We could borrow for less. We could have instant transfers. It turns out that the Fed actually processes $3 trillion worth of Fedwire transfers every day. You know, so they are a big bank, and they're set up to do real banking. So we could have instant transfers instead of having to wait a couple of days for our checks to clear, or even like credit card payments take a while, et cetera. We could have all that without fees, no deposit fees, no transfer fees, no debit card fees, no minimum balances, and there would be no deposit insurance limits. So right now, there's a $250,000 limit for FDIC insurance. So for these big depositors like pension funds and big money, they don't want to put, or even state and local governments, they don't want to put their money in a bank because it's not going to be FDIC insured. So they wind up putting their money in the repo market or the shadow banking system, which I won't go into the details of all that, but it's very risky. It was the shadow banking system that actually brought down the system in 2008. It was a run on the shadow banking system, not on the regular banks. I'm just finishing up a book on all this, and hopefully I've made it more clear in the book. But anyway, so you would actually obviate the need for shadow banks for that purpose. So that's one reason we have this big shadow banking system, is that all that big money needs a place to go to earn a little return. So they, too, could be making 1.75% putting their money with the Fed.
So they're suggesting with this program, which they call Fed Account, a contracted word, capital F and capital A, Fed Account, it's a one-on-one between every individual and the central bank. So you would have an Ellen Brown or a Walt McCree personal account at the Fed, and have all of the benefits that the big banks now use to make tons of profits just by managing the money, just by being the intermediary. So we would be eliminating a significant part of what the banking industry uses, you know, makes bank on, so to speak. A transformative thing that they say would be absolutely possible to do in a relatively small adjustment to the way the law is written about the Federal Reserve. So please go on with other impacts of this.
Well, so actually the Bank of England had talked about central bank digital currency and opening up their deposit window to everyone a couple of years ago. The downside that was perceived then, and it's still mentioned in the Bank of England study of May, is that if you pull all the deposits out of the big banks, they're not going to have any liquidity. So they're not going to be able to make loans. So where are you going to get the liquidity for the credit that we need for the, you know, credit makes the economy go around. But the proposal of the latest June study by the trio of two treasurers and a law professor.
Yeah, it's the Great Democracy Initiative. The people are Morgan Ricks, John Crawford, and Lev Menand.
Right. Okay, Morgan Ricks et al. They say, well, you can let the banks borrow from the central bank, from the Fed or the central bank. So presumably, the banks would be borrowing at something more than 1.75%, so maybe 2%, you know, something cheap, still cheap, but a little more than they have to pay right now. And so the Fed would actually be making a profit, which would be returned to the government, or, you know, they would deduct their costs, and they would still return this profit to the government. So even though the Fed would be paying more on all these deposit accounts, 1.75% for the whole country, which seems like a lot, it wouldn't matter because they would have all this money, these deposits, and they would do something with them. And one thing they would do would be to lend it to banks, which could then lend it to us. But I would suggest that everyone could also borrow from the central bank. I mean, certainly they should be able to lend directly to the federal government, directly to state and local governments. Right now, the federal government has to issue bonds through these bond dealers, most of which are big banks, and that's only like 22 of them or so. It's a very limited number of banks that are allowed to do this. So they get the banks get their cut, and then the Federal Reserve buys the bonds from the bond dealers. And this was done, according to Mariner Eccles, who was head of the central bank in the 1930s. This was done just to give the bond dealers their cut. It was sort of a concession to the banks because they had taken things away in those reforms of 1933. So that could be eliminated, that middleman deal could be eliminated and that the Federal Reserve could be lending directly to the central government, which would save the interest burden of our big debt. The big debt is really not a problem. It's the interest that keeps growing. The big debt could just sit there on the central bank's books and it wouldn't hurt anything. And you could do the same for state and local governments. Like right now, say you're doing infrastructure in a state or local government wants to do infrastructure. They have to issue bonds, maybe 4 or 5%. The bonds are to people in the community, investors, and then the investors get this interest year after year after year. Right. So what you could do is have the central bank lend directly to state and local governments, say at 2%. It's like the Bank of North Dakota does for their local governments, 2%. They make 2% infrastructure loans. Or a third option is to lend just directly to state and local government banks, public banks, what we've been talking about for a long time. And then the public banks would be in a position to make lower interest loans to state and local government infrastructure, et cetera, projects, and arguably to individuals.
Wouldn't it be a significant lift, though, an additional difficulty to have the federal government issuing credit to these groups?
Well, it shouldn't be a problem to issue credit to governments. It doesn't seem to be much different to buy bonds on the bond market and to buy the bonds or the debt directly from the federal government, state and local governments. I mean, they're not going to go bankrupt. They're not going to go anywhere. So you don't have to assess whether they're good credit risk. That's the same thing we've been arguing about having an infrastructure bank in California. These would be perfectly safe loans because once in a blue moon, a city will go bankrupt. But even if they do, they've still got a tax base. It's not like they're going to just fold and disappear like businesses that go bankrupt. You've always got somebody to tap up.
But even if they didn't get involved in lending money to cities, let alone individuals, it would allow the cities and state to put their money right directly in the bank, and the hundreds of billions of dollars of banking expenses would be eliminated for the public right there. Instead of having to take their money to Wells or Chase or Bank of America, they just put it right in their Fed account, and the administrations of the cities and the states would simply draw on that Fed account directly with no middleman. Great savings.
Right. And they could even, it seems to me, make loans directly to the public. I mean, a central bank would not be able, of course, to manage all those loans. Bob Hockett, who is a professor at Cornell, that we've interviewed him anyway, yes, he and some other people, wrote an interesting paper where he said that banks couldn't be able to operate except for the backup of the government, and therefore they should properly be franchisees of the government. They should be nonprofits working for the government. In other words, the banks could, you could have all the loan officers figuring out creditworthiness, et cetera, in the banks where they are now, but they would become part of the central system, or they would be public utilities, just as the central bank would be a public utility. It would all be a central system. That also freaks out some of these crypto anarchist types who think that, you know, you're giving all the power to the central government or to the government in general, but you're not compelled to bank there. You don't have to put your money there. You don't have to borrow there. You can go to a private bank, or you can borrow from private funds, et cetera, or you can go to the cryptocurrency market, or you can buy gold or whatever.
So you're basically saying that this proposal doesn't upend the availability or the various other components, aspects, or players in the market for lending and for managing deposits. You could deal with anybody you want to, but
right. But it would take away their perks, their special privileges that make them virtually a monopoly now. So you would also have public banks. A bank would not have to become a franchisee of the federal system, but they could, and it would be to their advantage because they would have cheap access to liquidity. I mean, especially the small banks that are now selling out to the big banks. Wouldn't you rather become a franchisee of a big public system that was designed to serve the public interest? It would be quite satisfying, I would think, for a banker.
And it's interesting, one of the points that they make at the very end, they said one final advantage deserves to be mentioned. They say, for most Americans, the central bank is an obscure and remote institution to which they feel little, if any, connection. With Fed account, people would experience this organ of the federal government working directly for them. As noted before in the report, they say, we think Fed account could play some role, however modest, in restoring doubting Americans' faith in that government, and can make a positive difference in their daily lives, which would be no small accomplishment, they conclude.
Right. And they also suggested, and we've suggested, using the post offices for the unbanked or the underbanked for small loans, or basically replacing payday loans, which are now at whatever, 400% or something like that. You could still charge enough to cover defaults. So I think when the post office was talking about that, I think they were figuring 28% or something, which sounds high, but compared to 400%, it's great.
Yeah, on my journey to France, I took a moment and stopped off at one of the post offices and found this very lovely, very simple, but thoroughly available banking installation in the post office, an ATM machine, one person with a computer and an ability to transact certain more complicated deals, a list of services, a very large list of a menu with rates and everything very clearly spelled out. It was just so obvious. It was like going to the store to buy a bottle of red wine, which I actually did. But going to the post office and taking care of your banking, it was just a no-brainer, and it was beautifully simple.
Right. They've already got much of this stuff is already automated. For example, if you apply for a credit card, that you don't sit down with the bank officer. You just fill out a form and they have a look, or somebody at some computer somewhere gives you the credit card and puts a credit limit on it, and they don't even ask what you're going to use that for. You can spend it on whatever you want. Of course, if you're getting a loan for a house, you probably will need a loan officer because they want to make sure that it's,
right.
Who to buy. Yeah, all right. Those.
A related component of that, Ellen, is in this Fed account idea, is that it would not charge any fees on payments, and that for credit cards and debit cards, there wouldn't be any interchange fees, which are basically taxes on merchants and on consumers. So there would be a big boon for merchants, particularly for small businesses who have expensive interchange and credit card charges.
And you would pretty much kill the big banks. That would be one major benefit, it seems to me, where everybody's trying to figure out how to eliminate the risk of these giant banks. Well, if you're not banking there, it's not a risk. Let them go bankrupt if they want. Let them gamble and fail. If they're not gambling with your money. Or if at least they're going to have to pay some pretty high interest on deposits to get people to deposit there, so at least it's going to be worth your while to have them gambling with your money. And because credit cards are such a big part of the big bank's business today, that's how they make loans. Instead of what used to be credit lines at 8% are now credit cards at 16%, which is really a killer for this small businesses, but very lucrative for the banks. You eliminated a good part of their business and moved the deposit base into the central bank. You would definitely downsize the big banks or make them specialists in stuff that we don't really care about. If it goes down, it goes down.
So this idea has been put forward by a group called the Great Democracy Initiative, and your work in this field, which I think is going to expand on this considerably, for the Democracy Collaborative, both point to the changes, the systemic structural changes that are underway now around our money, to be able to undo, diminish, somehow hopefully break up the monopoly of private issuance of money from the banking regime, which has been indomitable for hundreds of years, but that now must really give way. Because there's only so much blood you can get from the stone of the people, the stones of the people, and it's time for this sort of a structural adjustment. So it's very exciting to see this, and I'm expecting that you and I will be talking with the authors of this in coming shows about how to flesh out this idea even more, and that your own work will be something you'll be able to share with us in the very near future even more.
One other thing I'll talk about some other day is what the Chinese are doing, which is going to kill the banking system. Which, I mean, it's basic, okay. They're basically turning, it's like an Amazon with its own bank. In other words, it's all done with cell phones, so you don't need a bank, so you don't need an intermediary. And it's like a great big community currency where you've got Amazon, where you can buy anything you want, and you can sell anything you want. And the merchants, you know, just they don't even have to have those machines for credit cards. They just have a barcode that they stick up on their little cart that's out in the street, and everybody is using it. So they've essentially bypassed the bank.
That's very cool, and yet another example of how so much change is going on, that money, or at least as the methods of its use, become more democratized and its availability. We see it moving toward what we've been saying we want it to become, the utility, a public utility, which is what it must be for us to be able to survive and grow a sustainable and regenerative economy. Thanks, Ellen.
Well said. Thank you.
Okay, we'll talk soon.
Now, we take a look behind the curtain of global finance with commentator Bob Bowes, who lays out the fundamentals of how the global financial system works.
Much has been written and said about fixes that could be made to rationalize the U.S. and global economy. But unfortunately, almost all of the current proposals are completely within the box of the present monetary system, which means that, as a result, the planetary power structure and the income and asset gap between the 1% and the rest of us would not change. Additionally, most of these proposals are completely within the silo of the present political system based on assumptions that the reported vote totals actually reflect the way that the electorate votes, and that there is a substantive difference between the red and blue party marketing brands. But there's no evidence to support these assumptions based on forensic voting analysis and the actual effects of the legislation passed by federal, state, and most local governments. Of course, a modicum of superficial distinctions, which can change at any time, are necessary to maintain the illusion. The underlying cause for this state of affairs is private control over money creation, beginning with the Federal Reserve System, which prints private banknotes as the medium of exchange for the world's largest economy, as well as serving as the principal world reserve currency, involved in more than 80% of all foreign exchange transactions. The upshot of the U.S. taxpayers paying principal and interest, what the cartel refers to as the national debt, to use these private banknotes is that the U.S. is not a sovereign nation. That is, it does not issue its own currency. While it's understandable that many monetary reformists assume the current system is monolithic and that the reform is only possible within its current boundaries and terms, such assumptions have no precedent in world history, nor in a cosmos where change is constant, even if, in the blink of an eye that is our lifetime, we are unable to see the changes taking place. Putting aside the question of how the present power of the Anglo-Euro-American banking cartel is going to be challenged and how it will eventually disintegrate, which we discuss in steps 5 and 6 of our new book, 7 Steps to Global Economic and Spiritual Transformation, let us propose an alternative model which will hasten such a change. As Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution states, the power to create money is vested in Congress, and in Article 1, Section 10, the states are forbidden to issue paper currency. There is no power granted to allow Congress to assign this sovereign function. Clearly, then, it would require a constitutional amendment to change these provisions, which automatically excludes the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 from any legal foundation upon which to operate, if the federal judiciary, including the Supreme Court, were not puppets of the banking cartel. So to return our nation to a sovereign, constitutional, democratic republic would first require that all Federal Reserve notes be retired and replaced by dollars issued by these United States of America, the USA, an entity that differs legally from the U.S., which is a faux legal construct of the Anglo-Euro-American banking cartel, as we explain in Step 5 of our book. The process of converting the national legal tender and the reserve accounts held by over 150 nations around the world from FRNs to sovereign dollars would drastically change the power structure on much of the planet from one controlled by a few families to one controlled by sovereign nations. Such a process would necessarily involve some scrutiny over how certain FRNs were acquired, subject to codes that guide international conduct, including precepts drawn from sections of the Nuremberg Principles, the Geneva Convention, and the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, were any of these guidelines actually enforced. Within the USA, such a change would immediately retire the national debt via a payoff to a specific class of U.S. Treasury bondholders while voiding any unlawful bonds that were created under the guise of selling them to legitimate parties, while in fact it was the market makers, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, etc., which control the Fed, that were buying the bonds and hiding the fact via offshore transactions. In addition to reducing the liquid and capital assets held by the banking cartel, transformation to a sovereign currency would alter ownership and control of key industries, as well as alter the fulcrum point of political, economic, and military power in the USA and around the world. Just so, profiteering on war, disease, and education would be eradicated, and the prohibition of charging interest for the issuance of credit, which is now embedded in approximately 40% of all goods and services, would free up the productive capacity of the United States of America to repair our infrastructure, mend the social safety net, and encourage the deployment of machines, computers, robots, and artificial intelligence for menial and repetitive jobs, thus implementing the long-held human dream of reducing the required work week while providing universal income, healthcare, education, and cultural amenities. While capitalists may protest that their privately controlled system is responsible for the creation of so many of the assets from which we benefit, this is simply not the case, for it is credit that created these assets. But as we have seen, when credit is extended in a capitalist system, the 1% end up with 90% of the assets, and labor, which created the value, ends up with almost nothing. This would no longer be the case in a publicly controlled monetary system, where labor, no longer subject to capital's manufactured systemic failures, which are designed to steal the fruits of labor, would retain its share of the accumulated value it creates. As we discuss in Step 4 of our book, an economic system based on a public banking network and an economic bill of rights could monitor at local levels a basket of goods and services that includes food, clothing, shelter, education, health care, and cultural amenities for any inflationary or deflationary trends, much as is currently done with the Consumer Price Index, and make adjustments to the money supply via dividends, what we call humanity credits, or credit availability issued to or taxes collected from individuals, corporations, or political subdivisions. Most of these adjustments would be made at a local level. In this way, a rational and progressive monetary system initiated by these United States of America would engender global transformation. From behind the curtain, this is Bob Bowes.
Now let's take some encouragement, shall we, about the larger struggle for economic fairness and democratic control as we chat with George Lakey, noted author, Swarthmore professor, Quaker peace activist, and a founder of the Movement for a New Society, whose latest book entitled Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and We Can Too. As we move together toward the creation of new systemic responses for recapturing some monetary control for the public interest, George Lakey lays out what has worked in the past.
What is the essence of the Viking economics model that you think teach us a lesson and is an opportunity for us?
It puts the common good first. That's the overriding consideration. So on the one hand, it hugely promotes individual freedom. In fact, Norwegians, for example, have more individual freedom than we do. And on the other hand, puts a framework around people's individual choices such that the common good is also promoted. And they don't see a contradiction between those two. They believe that individual freedom is more likely to be enhanced when economic policies are organized around the common good as well. A century ago, Denmark and Sweden and Norway and Iceland, especially Iceland, were full of poverty. In fact, your listeners are probably aware that tons of Norwegians and Swedes fled their countries 100 years ago and even before because there was simply no economic opportunity over there for people who didn't already have some money or weren't the first sons of farmers, you know, who would inherit the land. They were simply countries that could not figure out, or at least their 1% could not figure out, how to create shared prosperity. And so a lot of people from Scandinavia came to the U.S., came to Canada and other countries. They're changed now to the point where they're top of the international ratings with regard to economic indicators. That's an enormous change. That's a sea change. So it's not even a matter of tweaking their way there. They actually had to come to a point of confrontation with the economic elite, which historically, of course, had run the countries. And they had basically to say, well, look, you're not doing very well. Look at your track record. You're doing very poorly. So we're firing you as the economic leadership of the country, and we're taking over instead. And so the majority of people took over in Norway, Sweden, and Denmark.
So the economic elite in Scandinavia were entrenched. How did the people manage to overcome the overwhelming, probably, power of the elite?
Well, one thing they did was develop a common vision of an alternative. And that was really important to inspire the sacrifice that was involved in making those changes. Because there was, of course, pushback from the economic elite. Troops were called out in both Sweden and in Norway, in Denmark at an earlier point. Troops were called out, repression, people were put in jail, people were killed, people were shot down while they were engaged nonviolently in campaigns for change. And so there was the pushback from the economic elite, and one of the things that inspired people to keep on going, keep on struggling in order to make their revolution was the fact that they had a vision of how different things could be. In fact, for them, it was a really visionary movement. They had to believe in the possibility that a democracy can create an economy that is democratic. And they believed. And so they did what I have written as a nonviolent revolution and pushed the 1%, pushed the economic elite out of power.
And how did that get propagated? How did they promulgate that vision? What sort of community resources?
Study groups were really important. It was routine for people to gather together in living rooms and churches and so on and talk about what do we really want. And there were economists, far-sighted economists, who were willing to work with the study group movement, with the adult education movement. And so they would put out these papers, you know, that would often be need to be translated by journalists into things that people could understand. So that was part of it. But another big part was the actual skill building that was involved in creating cooperative institutions. So they really did believe in co-ops at a very early point. The earliest people on that were Sweden. Swedes were the earliest ones to build a really strong co-op movement. So there you had ordinary people, farmers, small family farmers, and workers, and, you know, just ordinary folks, learning the skills of managing for themselves. They'd always been managed by someone else, right? This was their chance to learn what is it like to have an economic enterprise that works for the benefit of the whole. So that built confidence as well. So not only did they have their vision, but they had the confidence that grew from co-ops that worked better and this is still the case, co-ops working better than free enterprise was working. Some of the people who became leaders in the Norwegian movement came to the U.S. to learn how to be more effective labor organizers or how to be more effective co-op people, because at that time, 100 years ago, in some states, the U.S. was ahead of Scandinavia in terms of our own journey toward what I'm now calling Viking economics. There was very little social mobility. If you were born into a working-class family, that's how you would die. Very little social mobility, and there was more in comparison in the United States and in Canada, so that's one reason why they came across the Atlantic. And then that situation is reversed, so there's way more social mobility now in Scandinavia than there is in the United States. We're way more frozen and stuck in how people are born and then stay that way in their lives, and over there there's way more flexibility and mobility, which has to do with their enormous investment in education, quality education, free education, free higher education, for example. Go to university for free, go to colleges for free, go to all kinds of engineering school and, you know, whatever you name, ballet school, whatever you name, it's free over there because they have a huge commitment to education as a way that people can sort themselves out. And they don't say it's awful to be an auto mechanic or it's awful to be a farmer or, you know, awful to, you know, to be a trolley car driver. It's not that they diss working class jobs. And in fact, people have a very livable life as working class people. There's no poverty there. They pretty much gave up poverty, the Scandinavian countries did, because they thought people should not live in poverty. There's no excuse for it. So 19th century. So 19th century. Why would people bother to have poverty anymore? Yeah. And they went ahead and abolished poverty, which the United States could easily do as well, because we have a model for doing it and we have more resources than they do. But they went ahead and did that. It's that everyone should live in dignity, but if you happen to be born into a working class family, but you are gifted at, say, writing and scholarship, or you're gifted at piano playing or something, then you should go ahead and go right to the limit of your talent and your drive to be able to do that. And our job as society is to help you to do that, because that will actually support the common good.
It's just remarkable to hear that story, the citizen realities here in the U.S. about how locked in and absolutely overburdened with debt, such that that kind of a vision really sounds like blue sky, sort of an impossible dream. In the Scandinavian experience, it must have started with just a handful of folks.
That's right. Margaret Mead is right, and of course it did there as well. And that, to me, is very encouraging, because we do have plenty of small groups now in our society and things are picking up. But things took hold, partly because there was so much suffering. People were hungry. People were starving. Just as in the United States, hunger is growing as well. So the conditions in the U.S. are amazingly like the conditions 100 years ago over there. In fact, they also had a pretend democracy, right? They had a parliament. They had free elections. And so the propaganda about themselves coming from the economic elite was, well, we have democracy, but somehow the decisions that directed society were always made for the benefit of the economic elite, and that's the same as here. So I find a lot of parallels between them before, you know, as they were gathering to get ready to make their big shove, and here, because I think that's also what we're gathering to do, and that so many Americans are now seeing through the pretense of our democracy and realizing it's not enough to vote. Voting is all right, but it doesn't have really much power to it, and if you really want power, then you have to organize social movements that use nonviolent direct action to coerce the economic elite to get out of the way and let us have what we want.
We have similar sort of undertaking with the public banking movement as we call out the extraction of Wall Street from our communities. There's terrific change underway in the U.S. right now. You have a term called prefigurative politics, mm-hmm. and it follows education. but it precedes confrontation.
That's
right. Would you just say a couple of words about what prefigurative politics is?
What I like about it is that it prefigures the vision. So first comes the vision, and then we prefigure it. We figure it, we show it, we image it in the here and now in order that it has more tangibility. So, for example, if we want public banking, if we want Pennsylvania to follow North Dakota's example and have a state bank, we can gain some heart from knowing that credit unions outperform private banks. So in that sense, credit unions are a prefigurative institution, and members of boards of credit unions and the members themselves, like I'm a member of a credit union, and the people who work for credit unions, all can say, hey, we know that banking for the common good works because that's what we do, and our neighborhood benefits enormously from keeping the money here, investing it, you know, in my neighbor's kitchen rehab, investing it in the new car down the street. We know that it works for us, and that gives us a kind of confidence. And I really underline that word confidence because I find my fellow Americans with a limiting belief that we just aren't powerful. We can't be powerful. But actually, if we borrow our confidence from the fact that we've done so much already, then we can see that, yes, we have been powerful, and one of the ways we've been powerful is in doing that. There's talk about reinvigorating the old post office banks that used to exist in the postal system, and that was a very popular thing in Scandinavia as well. That was one of the forms of public banking. They had municipally owned banks, and they had state banks that still do, but they also have the postal system because it was so convenient, the post offices and so many neighborhoods, and people could deposit their savings there and build up their savings in that way. So sometimes we just need a reminder of how well we've done. Wait a minute, we don't have to be so intimidated by the Goldman Sachs's of the world. We could actually say, based on track record, public institutions are actually doing better than you are, and let's just move you out of the way and take that over.
Well, this is powerful, George. I appreciate it because my sense is that people really do need to be encouraged to rediscover their power as citizens. And with the discovery that of how badly we're being taken advantage of, and with the clear options that are on the table relative to alternatives, like the collectives that you're talking about, the cooperatives that you're talking about, it seems to me that there's a very big shift going back toward the local economy as opposed to trying to take a stand and make a play inside of a global economy, which is so out of touch with most people. Is it your sense, too, that structurally and systemically that this is kind of the way forward, the way around the obstacle of elite control?
Well, it's a wonderful trend. I see it, too. You see it more than I do because you've really focused on that in a particularly wonderful way. But I also see it as I travel around doing bookstore tours. And it's a very, very heartening thing. However, I do run into folks who set those two change modes in opposition to each other, as if prefigurative institutions, like our efforts to do public banking and the credit unions and so on, the transition town movement, that sort of thing, as if that is in contradiction to nonviolent direct action campaigns. And I think the Scandinavians had it right. They did both at the same time. Mm-hmm. And the big advantage of doing both at the same time, and that doesn't mean that each individual does both at the same time, because after all, we have to take responsibility for our own time budget. And it would be pretty impossible to start a co-op and also do a campaign at the same time. But that the movement support each other in doing both of those, because the one feeds the other. The confidence that we gain from the prefigurative institutions gives us more heart for confronting the existing capitalist institutions like PNC Bank and stopping them from doing nasty things. And the Scandinavian example, which is the clearest example of success in moving an economy hugely forward, it shows that prefigurative institutions can only go so far before the 1%, the economic elite, pushes back in their own interests. It's totally natural. It doesn't mean they're nasty. It just means that they're pushing back in their own interests. And so they will push back, and we have to have the skills and courage and solidarity to be able to push harder than they do. That's what we need. And it's and building alternative institutions doesn't necessarily give us that. We can be so focused on the bookkeeping or the sheer management of an enterprise, even a people's enterprise, that we forget the skills of nonviolent struggle. And nonviolent struggle is absolutely central, because without it, we simply can't coerce the economic elite to move out of its leadership role of the whole economy. And so the alternatives that you and I love will always just play a little sister role in the economy. They can never direct the economy until those who do direct the economy are pushed out of the way. And the reality is that can be done. That can be done. And that's and my book demonstrates that, both in the live examples in Scandinavia, and also shows in the last chapter how we can do that here in this country, partly because we have an amazing track record of partial achievement in that way. And what we can do is use what we've learned in our partial achievement and take it all the way.
And you say that that possibility exists, even though the global financial cartel that really is into everything is so huge that you still maintain that the people can impact its control and its domination.
That's right. And that's one reason why I called it Viking economics, in order to remind ourselves how very small those Viking boats were. Nevertheless, crossed not only the North Sea to Britain, but even crossed the Atlantic, the mighty North Atlantic. And that's what those small countries did. Remember, Norway never lived in a time that wasn't globalized. Norway never lived in a time when it wasn't dependent on global market forces that were way bigger than the Norwegians were. They never had it their way, in the sense that the U.S. has had it our way. And they were up against enormous forces. So was Sweden, so was Denmark, and so was Iceland. Iceland, most of all, only 320,000 people in Iceland. Talk about being at the mercy of humongous forces. And the point is that their ability to transform their own societies, despite the fact that they always experienced globalization, means that we, with our huge economy, we're still the number one economy in the world. Yes, we can take on the global scale. We, again, need to be in touch with our powerfulness instead of making excuses for powerlessness, which is never the way to get something done.
That's beautiful. I thank you very much, George, for this conversation. And I, the metaphor that I'm sticking in my mind is this beautiful, this idea of our own personal little boats, the ability to transcend and to discover entirely new possibilities is really at the heart of this movement. And you've expressed it so beautifully. Thank you so much for this conversation today, George.
Thanks for the opportunity.
That's George Lakey, author of the new book, Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right, and We Can Too. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.